You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Morning, everyone, and welcome to the Cool Project Show on America's Web Radio. I am your host, Michelle Molyneux, and we will be talking to people from around the world who have projects. Today, we're in for a treat. We have David Granger, a wildlife artist, novelist, president of the Guild of Automotive Restorers, one of the world's leading automotive restoration shops in North America. He is also the principal character on the popular TV show called Restoration Garage, which is seen on Canada's History Channel and on the Discovery Velocity Channel in America. David, welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning, Michelle.
Well, thank you for coming to the show, and let's get cracking and talk about you and your fascinating background, and then we'll also talk a little bit more about how did you get into restoration?
Oh, well, restoration was, I guess the easiest way to say it is that I was a professional artist for many years and broke for quite a few of those. And I bought myself an old Land Rover because I needed to get into the bush. And that's about the worst vehicle in the world to buy if you have no mechanical aptitudes whatsoever, which I didn't at the time. And over the course of a couple of years, I basically had to rebuild every system in that truck because I couldn't afford to get it repaired anywhere. And then tinkering with old vehicles sort of leapt on from that. It was a great way at the end of a day after being, after painting all day long, which can be pretty taxing when you're painting for big shows and that kind of thing. I needed a way to sort of kick back and relax once I lost the lights, so I would. I had a whole bunch of old military vehicles, and I'd go out and bang and crash and thump and bruise my fingers and have a good time. And then many years ago, I met Janice, my wife, and she looked at me one day and says, "Geez, why don't you work on something that people want?" And so we went to a wrecking yard. We used to, our dates were quite often composed of visits to wrecking yards. And we found an old Corvette, and we bought it and brought it home, and we started working on that. It was one of the worst cars I've ever had, and I don't think it was a whole bunch better when we were finished with it than when we started with it, but we learned a lot. And, the entire thing has grown from there.
Wow. And how long ago was that? So how long has Restoration Garage been around?
Well, the Guild, we just are having our 25th anniversary now. And, I had worked on vehicles for years before we organized this as a company. But, the seeds were really sown for this probably a little over 30 years ago.
Well, now you had mentioned military. You started off with restoring or tinkering with military vehicles. What kind?
Yeah, the Land Rover sort of led into other civilian vehicles. And then, in those days, you could buy an old Dodge M37 military truck for $800 to $1,000. And I actually bought one that with 800 miles on it for $800. Canadian military surplus. It was an old weapons carrier, and I mean, it did a whole 45 miles an hour full out, and it drank copious amounts of fuel, so I was always running out of gas. But, it started this love affair, and it wasn't because I like military stuff because of what it does. I like it because of what it looks like and what it's capable of as far as, driving and all that kind of thing. So, it went from Jeeps to trucks to armored cars to even tanks. And, I got smart and followed Janice's advice and started working on things that people actually wanted.
But you were an artist for many years. What kind of artwork were you doing?
I was a wildlife artist for 17 or 18 years. And, and environmentalist and, sort of fought the fight and laid down in front of the bulldozers and everything. When it wasn't, well, when everybody just thought you were nuts. I mean, people look at me and go, "You do what?" it wasn't very well understood in the 70s and 80s. Certainly not like it is now, but I was there.
Well, you were ahead of the times for environmental issues. And so now with your, and so how did you build that reputation? Because the Auto Guild, you know, you have a lot of projects going on there. So how did you start marketing and building your reputation?
Yeah, you know, honestly, it started off in a front yard. I was immensely popular with the neighbors. Had a, like an old 47 Nash and about six or seven other vehicles out front, and you know, was working on those, and dreamt of the time when I wouldn't be laying on my back in the snow working on a car. And then we eventually rented a place that had a garage that had a concrete floor, and you could get two cars in it. And that was really the launch of it. I had some friends that sort of came in to help out, and we just started to advertise. And, you know, we basically fulfilled a need. You know, in no time at all, a two-car garage was just not large enough. And, you know, we moved into a 3,000-square-foot building, and then we added another couple of thousand feet to that, and then moved to a 10,000-square-foot building. And now we're in, well, we're in a building we've been in for a long time, and it's well over 20,000 square feet, which isn't huge and everything, but I'm really resistant to getting even, you know, more space than this, because I filled this whole place up with crap.
Oh, no.
You know, there's no room to move. Matter of fact, I'm having an auction soon just to get rid of all the stuff that I seem to have accumulated over the last 25 years so I can start again. But right. We also are working on, you know, anywhere from at a low point, 25, up to 50 projects at a time.
So how much stuff do you have there then? That's a huge building. You know, that's to me, I envision that. That's a small museum exhibit floor space. That's quite large.
Yeah. We have generally the staff on the floor staff, not support staff, but the people on the floor, we like to have 15 to 18 on the floor. Mm-hmm. And we can sort of keep up with the flow of the projects. And we, you know, over 25 years, you sort of tend to you know, build a system that works. So, you know, we become fairly efficient, and nothing sits for long lengths of time unattended for reasons other than usually waiting for parts.
Oh, yeah, waiting for parts. How do you find those parts, especially for, you know,
well, you know, it used to be a lot easier than it is now, and that is without the Internet in the equation. You know, when we started this off 20, 25, 30 years ago, you had a lot of different people that had a lot of different parts for things. And then over the years, you know, the sort of the hobbyist professionals, if I can call them that, guys who had retired who decided to sell Corvette parts or 56 Ford parts or Model A parts, you know, over the years, you know, those were literally hobby businesses. I mean, you didn't get rich doing it. And, you know, when they passed away, quite often the families would just sort of auction all the stuff or even throw it out, because a lot of times people didn't know what it was, you know, because these guys didn't keep accurate records or anything. So you ended up with these sort of suppliers that you could find in printed publications and through club associations or anything. They gradually all disappeared. So, and the other thing was, a lot of the original parts literally got used up. You know, I mean, factory original parts for 57 Chevys used to exist when I started this. And I mean, now, if you found one, it would be absolutely exceptional. So instead, what we have is reproduction parts. And honestly, most of the time, they are an absolute problem all of their own, because, you know, you buy a whole bunch of parts for something, and they just don't fit. You know, the quality is poor. And the fit is just awful, and, you know, you're sort of back to square one quite often when you just about think you've beat the problem.
Right, right. You know, I was just actually in an auto restoration shop, and the amount of custom design work that they had to do with welding and reshaping purchased items to fit into one of their cars, it was, you know, many hours worth of work. You know, it was just extraordinary.
Yeah, people don't understand how many hours these processes take. You know, it's one thing to, you know, I've had people say, well, geez, I got a big tune-up on my BMW last week, and it only took so long. And that, well, yeah, but, you know, the guys at the BMW dealership went to the parts department and grabbed the parts off the shelf and shoved them on the car after the computer told them what to change. And when we take your, you know, 35- or 40-year-old BMW apart, we have to source the parts from all over the world quite often, or we, in many cases, when parts are not available, we make them. And, you know, and certainly that's the case with 1920s and 30s cars. And I mean, the amount of parts we make goes from the odd little odd end for a car right through to creating an entire car. I mean, we're doing a 250 GT California Spider right now, and I mean, we're creating the entire car, literally. You know, we have Ferrari engine and drivetrain, but other than that, the entire body of the car and all the fittings and all the interior and the roof and everything we have to make here by hand.
That shows great passion for the owner for that car, you know, wanting to actually restore that.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a passion. You know, some owners come into the process and they don't understand and they don't listen. You know, they don't listen to us at the other end, and of course, then they get themselves in trouble, you know, through the project. But generally, we tend to give the best guidance possible, and I do spend an awful lot of time talking people out of restoring things.
You know, really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we probably turn away more work or suggest alternative ways for people to get their goal, you know, to get their goals achieved, you know, because, you know, sometimes something will come in the door and it's just not worth it in any way, shape, or form. You know, there's I won't say it's a rare occasion when an owner says, no, I don't care how bad it is. I want this car because this is the car that means something special to me, and another car like it won't do. But, you know, quite often we'll, you know, we substitute cars for, you know, simply because, you know, if you've got a 67 Camaro and you haven't owned one but you want one, you buy an old wreck and you bring it to us, we say, no, listen, we can find you a much better car for a whole bunch less money than restoring this, then we'll talk to people and try to do that.
Right.
You know, because it's a punitive procedure from a financial standpoint quite often, and people have to be prepared for that, because when you're hand-building a car, well, we all know, you know, Rolls-Royce hand-built car, how much are they now?
Right.
But when they're hand-building those cars, all the parts are on the shelf. When we're hand-building a car, the parts might be on the shelf, but they're worn right out and covered in grease.
Well, what we'll do is we'll talk a little bit more when we come right back from our break about this. I think this is a very interesting subject. Coming up next, we'll talk more with David from Restoration Garage, and we'll talk more about his projects. We'll be right back.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
It's not just your garden. It's the way you live. And there's so much to know. But you have help. Bonnie Plants. Now with Bonnie's app, Homegrown, you can learn about veggie and herb varieties. Track and record your garden with photos and notes. Share on Facebook and Twitter, and so much more. How'd you ever grow without it? Get Homegrown with Bonnie Plants for iPhone and Android. The more you know, the better you can grow with Bonnie.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Cool Project Show, and today we're talking with David Granger. Now, we were just actually talking about how you do need to sometimes talk to people in saying this may not be financially viable in restoring their cars. Do you usually get a lot of resistance, or do people decide that, okay, I understand it, and they walk away from a project? How do you actually handle that?
Well, you know, I think a lot of times people have a perception built from, literally these days, from television. You know, there's an awful lot of these car-related automotive shows that just are complete fabrications. You know, they're scripted it's okay to say, oh, we did this car in 3 weeks, but, you know, in reality, that's really not possible unless you've got an immense staff on it and all the parts were waiting for it and all of the outsourcing was basically waiting for it, like chrome. You know, I've got cars here that we've been waiting a year or more for chrome, and you know, I've got a 1948 Delahaye, and this is a multi-million-dollar car. The chrome has been an issue for 4 years. We finally got it all in. And we started to assemble a car, and the first batch of chrome we got from an American chrome shop don't fit because the chrome's too thick, and the last $20,000 worth of this chrome we got in just wasn't good enough to put on the car. So, you know, have $85,000 tied up in chrome that you still can't put on a car, you know, and 4 years of waiting around for it. So, you know, there's all of these factors that come in that people, you know, don't understand. They think that, geez, on that TV show, they restored a car in 3 weeks for $40,000. And that's just not, you know, that's not reality. You know, cars can take anywhere from 1,000 to 3,000 or 4,000 hours to restore, depending on the car and the complexity and how many parts need to be made. And you know, there's people don't understand show quality and driver quality and conqueror quality. And then there's huge variances there, too. I mean, a lot of people come and say, oh, I want a show-quality car. Well, what is your perception of show quality? Because literally their perception of show quality and mine may be completely different. When I think show quality, I think Pebble Beach. They may be thinking, you know, the local Rotary Club car event.
Right.
And, you know, Pebble Beach, those cars can take anywhere from 6,000 to 12,000 hours of labor to create that Concours capable and car, a car that will be taken serious on the lawn. And, you know, and those cars are not driven. As soon as they're driven, they're no longer really considered Concours quality. So, you know, it's sort of a silly world. People say, well, my God, why do people do it? Well, why do people race Formula Ones and NASCAR and everything? It's a competitive thing. You know, it really doesn't have a lot of bearing on going to the local cruise night and getting a trophy. So,
right.
You know, people have to understand those things. So when they make, you know, I really want this perfect, I want this show quality. No, you actually don't. And that's something we have to tell people, you know. You don't want every screw lined up in perfect order and every valley and every screw being exactly the right shape for the period it was made. I mean, that's how ridiculous Concours can get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what people really want is, you know, and then you get the other side. I just want a driver. Well, yeah, but by the time you finish spending money, it better look like a show car. You know, even if a judge at a big event will go, well, no, that's not a perfect car. So, you know, there's this tightrope that the restorer walks all the time between over-restoring a car for somebody who doesn't understand that or under-restoring it for somebody who wants more. You know, and, you know, so really you have to sit down and the guy with the car has to understand where he's going and he has to be, you know, informed all the way through the process. It's a very complex process. We've had cars that are, you know, 7,000 or 8,000 or 9,000 hours in time. You know, I think the Bugatti, which is a world famous car now, I think we had about 14,000 hours. I mean, it was exceptional because it was made from magnesium and every part of the car that you see with the hood closed we've made here, including the tires. But, you bring in your little Triumph TR3, and it's still, you know, if it's a ratty old wreck, when you're finished, it might be worth $30,000 to $40,000, but it's still going to take 1,500 or 2,000 hours to put it right.
So just tell me, you know, like over the years, some of the key highlights of projects, like what were the ones that really meant a lot for you?
Yeah, you know, I've had an awful lot of fun doing this over the years, and I've had a lot of things that sort of stand out. And funnily enough, I mean, there was a 32 Buick that we did, and it was a car that had been pushed into a gorge by a bulldozer when they were cleaning a lot, and it sat upside down in this gorge for God knows how many years, and it got pulled out and brought to me to be restored. And that was really the first car we restored as a company. And, you know, I had the pleasure of actually probably 20 years later offering that car for sale in my showroom for the original owner, and it looked as good. So that sort of meant a lot because it was, you know, the first one. We did one of the Batmobiles, and I got to meet George Barris at that time, and Bob Butts at Fantasy Car and El Cajon, and I was sort of introduced around to guys who were my heroes. The guys in the 50s and 60s, the great customizers. And I was taken around and taken to their shops, and met them, and that was honestly a dream come true. Where I'm sitting down with George Barris, and I'm sitting down with Dick Dean and Dean Jeffries. These guys were, just. When I was a kid, I was building models of the cars that those guys were designing and building, And it was funny because now I've actually restored some of the cars that they built then. Like I did Supervan, and it was really, when I was a kid, I built a model of it, and later on in life, I restored the real thing, That was pretty
cool.
That's
amazing. That is really cool. And
so, Sorry.
No, I was just going to say you've had clients from all over the world as well.
Yeah, we do. We still have. We have inquiries. I've had a lot of European clients and English clients. We have a large amount of our day-to-day clientele is American. Sometimes that the numbers of American clients is the number of Canadian clients by 60 or 70%. And that's nice because, when you're doing cars for people from all over, it gets your name out, but it's also fun meeting people. I got to become great friends with people from Kuwait who I just, I really, really enjoyed them. And while the cultures are, of course, very different, the people are all the same. Their sense of humor was great. When I first got to Kuwait, I was nervous. I was sort of by myself in this completely foreign environment, and it was funny because they took me out to dinner that night, and I'm sitting in an exotic restaurant eating food. I had no idea what the name was. but we were all arguing about the merits of a 69 Mustang compared to a 69 Chevelle, and getting quite heated about it. And I just sat there and I thought, this is really amusing because there's all of these guys sitting around from a completely different culture, and all the same guys arguing about the same stuff and who's got their favorite muscle cars.
That's amazing.
I've had fan mail. I had a fan mail from two fans, both basically expressing how excited they were about something they'd seen on the show. And they both came in the same day. And one of those fans was in Iran and one was in Israel. And I thought that was sort of cool.
What other kinds of products have you done that's not car-related?
Oh, over the years? Well, as far as restoring things are concerned, I dabble with antique and classic tractors and still fool about with old military trucks. I have a real passion. If anybody asks me what my true passion is as far as mechanical things is concerned, it's 1920s and 30s airplanes. Yeah, and I have a very small collection of those, and as many weekends as I can liberate the time, I fly. I've got a 1935 Waco cabin biplane, which is basically it was a luxury aircraft built for the rich or corporate use and everything, just sort of like a modern day private jet. And it's just a great old piece of its most beautiful Art Deco airplane. It has a lot of character, which, things in the 1920s and 30s, because they were hand-built, have sort of more character than modern vehicles. And, of course, age and patina lay more character on them as well. Of course, you don't want an airplane having too much character because, usually it's like a Jaguar. Jaguars have a lot of character, which means they break down a lot.
So how many planes do you have then?
Well, I had four, which was really stupid, because, and I've just sold one, so I only have three now. But one is an old 1930s racing aircraft, which I crashed a few years ago, and I'm still sort of tinkering and putting back together again. And then I've got a World War II trainer, which is a biplane, Myers OTW, just a cool airplane to go chugging around the sky in when you're, sort of outside.
Right.
And then the Waco. And the Waco, interestingly enough, I bought off a gentleman by the name of Jeff Skiles, and Jeff was the co-pilot of the aircraft that landed in the Hudson. So Jeff and I have become quite good friends over the years, and it's but fun flying with them, except we're always a little bit nervous about birds.
Yes. I hear you on that. Especially the Canada geese.
Yeah.
So now, do you also do a lot of traveling? I mean, you talked about Kuwait, but do you also go to your client sites as well, or in regard?
No, well, you know, as far as clients are concerned, I do tend to, you know, we basically don't travel to them. And I think when I first started the business, you know, I used to run all over the place, going and visiting people's cars in their garages. But, you know, the trouble was it really didn't mean anything. So, you know, the way we do it now is basically we pick up the cars and we bring them in here. And then it's much better if a car's owner comes to us, even before the car comes, because I would prefer that they know us, they feel comfortable with the process, they understand the process, so we can show them how we do things, you know, how cars are taken apart, how we source parts, and they get to meet the people actually doing it, or at least see the guys who are actually doing it. So there's a sense of comfort that instills, which is better than me running off and standing in the guy's garage telling him how clever I am.
And then they also get the reality of how long it could potentially take.
You can draw comparisons. Yeah, you can say, well, that car, you know, it's been taking this long, it's cost that much in parts. Is this what you want to achieve? You know, the more an owner knows about their car and restoration in general, the easier my job becomes. You know, there's nothing worse than having a client who really doesn't have any interest in their car at all, and they just... you know, they don't even bother to phone, and they don't answer phone calls or anything. They just expect, well, why wasn't my car finished in May? What the hell? You told me it might be in May. Well, we said we'd try for May, but we told you in October that these parts weren't available, and we were, you know, and that kind of thing. Because, now you set it up as a hostile relationship, because it's sort of us against them. And really, it's, you know, a good restorer and a car's owner should be a team working to tackle all the problems that the car throws at them, because the cars are really good at that. You know, so, I mean, you know, really, you know, an owner should, has the obligation to be in contact with the restorer. And even if the restorer, I mean, there's a lot of guys restoring, you know, cars that aren't good communicators. They're really good at what they do, but they're not good communicators. And there's some guys restoring cars who aren't good at restoring either. It really should be the owner's obligation to know the restorer. And if the restorer's not talking to them, talk to the restorer. Know where their project is and be involved in the decision-making on those projects. This is, you know, it's okay to for a restorer to make decisions, but they should always be based on the advice of the guy who owns the car. And he should be educated so that he can offer the advice to get the car that he wants to achieve at the end.
Well, coming right up, we'll talk more with David and hear more about some of his amazing projects. And we'll also talk about the future of the auto restoration industry sector. We'll be right back.
The disease of addiction is a life-altering challenge, not just for the person suffering its effects, but also for the family and friends who support and love the one caught in its grasp. What should be the course of treatment? Who is the best person to render treatment? And what is the best place to go for the care that is needed? We know that you want answers to these and many more questions. Call 770-696-9862 and speak to a representative of the Atlanta Healing Center. They can tailor a program specifically designed to address the needs of the person suffering with an addiction or give you guidance as to where that help may be found. Information is the key, and the trained staff at AHC is here to assist. If you wish, you can also get more information on the website located at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
When four members of Congress all die within 4 months, each of their deaths appears to be from natural causes. But when mysterious messages begin to appear in the form of quotations from long-dead revolutionary heroes, one reporter sets out to prove the existence of a serial killer. His search discovers dark secrets and an assassin shielded by people who need the very services that only he can provide. The Sun Silas Rising, a novel by Doug Dahlgren, on Kindle or paperback through Amazon.com.
Whether cruising the strip in a 57 Chevy or taking the family on a vacation in a 71 Oldsmobile Vista Cruiser, You need to tune in to Classic Cars with Steve Ronaldo and Jim Weber every Saturday from 8 to 9 a.m. on AmericasWebRadio.com.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Cool Project Show, and with me today we have David Granger, the principal person on the hit TV show called Restoration Garage, which is on America's Discovery Velocity Channel and also on Canada's History Channel. First of all, tell us, how did you get into the Restoration Garage show?
Well, you know, over the last 20 years or so, we've been involved in other television productions and all that kind of thing, but quite honestly, having done a series for an American network, it really didn't do us any good. It brought us no customers or anything because of the nature of the series. I was sort of dismissive, and we would get three or four or five production companies phoning with some of these really wacky ideas, especially when car TV became very popular. You know, and they'd phone up and they'd have all these wacky ideas. I'd say, well, you know, I don't see how that could work. And at that point, they'd say, yeah, okay, well, thank you. And that was the end of the conversation. But I got a phone call from a development producer from Pixcom Entertainment in Montreal. And she pitched me, Meredith Folks was her name, and she pitched me this idea. And I said, well, you know, I really don't think that'll work. And rather than saying, well, thank you very much for putting the phone down, she said, well, why won't it work? And what would work? And so we literally talked for the next hour and put together the show that everybody's seen as Restoration Garage. And they were great because it came with certain terms and conditions. I mean, I said, you know, I don't want to do a scripted show. There's enough drama that's real that we're not going to create drama, that we're not going to basically do things or pretend that we're doing things that aren't actually being done. And I said, I can't ever promise you that you're going to have a finished car at the end of every show, but I can certainly promise you that we'll have finished stories at the end of every show. Because that there's so many stories going on that's actually quite easy to do, and interesting stories for the main. So, I mean, they were up for that, and they've been great. They're, you know, great production company and really, really talented people. So we were very lucky, and, it's been very happy. I think the public can sort of see it's more documentary than reality, if you know what I mean. And,
yes.
Has...
More educational.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to, I'm not trying to educate people. I mean, at the end of the day, it is an entertainment, but, you know, if they learn things or if it interests them, that's absolutely a bonus, for sure. And, I said, I can remember saying to Meredith, if I'm going to do a TV show, I would like to show that when the guy's sitting there in his living room watching and his wife walks by, the show stops or she sits down and watches it as well. Mm-hmm. And I think we actually achieved that. And as a matter of fact, I had a gentleman in yesterday who was saying he has a friend in the States who'd been watching the show and was absolutely a fan of the show and yet had no real interest in cars or anything like that. He was not a gearhead and doesn't have classic and antique cars, and yet he was a real fan of the show. That's sort of where I wanted to go. And, I mean, that's where we're going to push into season 3 as well when we start shooting, which is just we're going to launch off in a couple of weeks. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, off we go again.
Yeah. How long does it take to make each show, then?
Yeah, they come in here, the crew comes in, and, because it's scripted, because it's not scripted, the director, Joe Viatra, he has no clue what's going to happen that day, and neither do I, and, because that's the nature of the beast. And it is really sort of punitive for them, because, I mean, with a scripted show, the crews can come in and they can wrap up a whole season in just a very, very short amount of time. But with this, they really have got to stay around. They stay around for 7 or 8 or 9 months, and then quite often they're doing pickups and catches right through till, season 2, we were actually filming and they were editing while the first show of the season was showing on TV. And I'll tell you, Manu, who was the producer, she was just pulling her hair out because, I mean, you guys are, they like to be 5 or 6 months finished before the show goes to air. So it's a real tough thing for them to film, and it makes it easier for us because we just basically bumble through our usual days, and every now and then we're asked to, maybe come through a door again, because the camera was in the wrong position or that kind of thing. But for the most part, you know, if they don't get it the first time, it's that's it. It's move on. So.
So how many how many cameras do you have then in your garage, and you know the number of you know film crew then?
Yeah, there's you know it ebbs and flows. You know, sometimes we'll have like a crew of seven or eight people, and we've had as many as three cameras rolling at the same time. And that was first season. That was actually more often the case. But they ended up with so much material. I think that you know the editors must have felt like killing the crew. You know, because they you know they had thousands and thousands of hours of recordings, and they're trying to you know, get stories out of it and you know condense it all. Second season, we you know they were a little more discriminating, but the directions they took, they aimed the cameras. Plus, we put up stationary cameras. So when a project was in place, there was a camera there that was turned on in the morning and turned off in the evening, and then they could go in and if they weren't missing things because the crew was somewhere else in the shop or, you know. So generally, there's a crew of, there's a director and a cameraman and a sound man and production assistant quite often, what they call a writer, and it's somebody who's basically keeping track of what the storylines are and so they can do the narrations and everything. So
because you have so many projects going on at the same time, do they do you pre-decide which projects will be filmed? Do you have to get the approval of the owner of the cars?
Yeah, it's always a good thing to you don't need the approval of the owner if the owner's not going to be in it, and we absolutely make sure we have people's permission, because I mean there's been some people who really don't want their car on TV, you know, and we're very careful that it doesn't even get into the background in the shots. But you know, that's the exception. But the production company is always much happier when the owner is going to be up front and on camera and excited about the project, because they want that, the other side. They want the feedback from the other side, not just our side, you know. So as far as deciding which projects, they sort of, I sit down with the producer and I go over the stuff and they'll say, oh, we really like that. I say, yeah, but that's not really going to go anywhere. I don't think we're going to be able to work on that too much. I don't think that the budgets are in place for it, or I don't think, you know. So they sort of lean a lot on my experience doing this kind of thing to sort of aim them at the projects that I think are going to come to fruition. And,
right.
You know, because... you know, there's a lot of times I look at something and I think that's going to grind to a halt halfway through, you know, certainly during the shooting season. You know, a few times in the first season I was proven right, so in the second season we sort of streamlined the process.
Yeah. And this show has been hugely successful on the Discovery Velocity channel as well.
Yeah, you know, you know, you always hope that people are going to like what you do, but it's been very pleasing, I have to say. It's sort of weird being treated like some kind of, you know, film star or something. You know, it's not just when I'm at car events. It's, you know, I'm trying to buy a pair of shoes to walk in the surf in California, and I'm in a drugstore, and I'm firmly attached to the wall by the security chain trying to put this shoe on. And I lost my balance, and I'm bouncing around just in the middle of that. I hear, "Oh my God, you're Dave, the guy from that TV show." You know, I'm like, so it has its moments. You know, I think probably the most memorable one was being chased down an alleyway in Venice by a fan, which I really...
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. And again, in Milan, or in Turin, I was... you know, so it's really funny because pretty much, you know, everywhere we go, because the show is around the world, it plays on TVs in Asia and Australia and New Zealand, where we have a huge fan base now, and you know, most European countries get it. It goes to the Middle East, so you know, it's really getting out there, even Central and South America. So it's been rather interesting.
When does it air?
Going to be Discovery Velocity is looking to premiere the show in January of 2017.
Okay,
so that'll be third season.
Are they doing reruns right now?
Oh yeah, I mean it's really funny. I always know that it's playing somewhere because I get email from people. You know, if I get a lot of email from Holland and that, I know that they're playing the series there. So we sort of tell when when it's been on the night before. And it is, it's played an awful lot, and now I get an awful lot of people saying, geez, I keep on seeing the same shows, when are you doing more? So I mean, it's nice to be able to say, hey, we're just about to start shooting season 3, and just be patient with us. And
right. Okay, well, what we'll do is we'll post up on the Cool Project site where they can actually find the show. Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to ask you was... the auto restoration industry, because of all of these shows, is definitely beginning to get more and more popular. Do you find that more people are wanting to be engaged in auto restoration because of the popularity on the TV?
Yeah, if you talk about people who actually want to do the restoration work themselves.
Yeah.
One of the biggest problems we have these days is actually getting the craftsmen who can do the work. You know, when I first started with this, I didn't have a problem getting coach builders and panel beaters and things like that, because there was guys who were in their 50s and 60s and even into their 70s who had trained and done it in the 40s and 50s and in the 60s. And they were still around and they were still doing it. But, you know, what's happened is we've lost a lot of these guys with that kind of talent. And largely their skills were lost with them. You know, there was not young guys doing apprenticeships, waiting in line to learn the skills involved with this kind of thing. And there's many reasons for that. I mean, let's face it, there's just not a lot of coach-built cars being built. And, you know, restoration as an industry is big, but it's tiny in comparison to most industries. And modern cars don't encourage tinkering. You know, when I was a kid, people tinkered with their cars. And you had to, you know, literally, there was things drivers had to do. I mean, a driver's handbook used to quite often tell you how to do a valve job on your car. But, you know, now your manual basically is to tell you to leave the car alone, don't open the hood, and here's how you operate the radio. You know, so, modern cars and all that kind of don't encourage tinkering. As a matter of fact, you can't tinker with them. And so younger people don't come up with that. I mean, they don't have to work on their car to get it going. They can't, you know, they can soup it up, but they go to the local performance store and buy some blue or pink piece and put it on, and it doesn't really soup it up. It just changes the look of it, you know. So, you know, the world has changed, and those skills are being lost. So we really have a hard time fulfilling it. So what we do is, you know, when we do get young guys that have the talent and they're still out there, then we basically have got to start from scratch and teach them skills that, you know, really are disappearing at this point. So, you know, in that, I've spent a lot of my time in the last 20 years basically grooming, you know, new and young and enthusiastic guys and putting them with older guys, you know, who have skills. You know, but there's so much involved. You know, there used to be something called babbitting, where you poured antimony and lead into to make the bearings for the crankshaft and piston rods to run on, and that used to be something that was done at the corner gas station. And now you can't find anybody who does it anymore. You know, there's the odd place, and they've got a waiting list and everything. So you either have to learn how to do it yourself, or you have to find a way of making an old engine newer by adapting it to modern process. You know. So gradually, as time goes on, I can see more and more skills being lost. We have to come up with new solutions, and we have to find young guys that are want to do more than just sit at computer consoles and, you know, work at the gas.
Well, you know what? When we come right back, let's talk more about that and how we can get more people engaged into auto restoration. We'll be right back on America's Red Radio.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on americaswebradio.com.
Cook Immigration Partners is your passport through the immigration maze. Whether it's help with E-Verify in your business, or help in how to document a new employee under the new I-9 rules, or if you marry a foreign national, Cook Immigration Partners is your best choice for a legal advocate. Call us today at 866-286-6200. That's 866-286-6200. Or visit us on the web at www.immigration.net.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
America's Web Radio is the most diverse and informative radio station anywhere in cyberspace. We have shows about health, business, current events, entertainment, home care, and everything in between. We appreciate your continued support of America's Web Radio.
Welcome back to the Cool Project Show, and in our last segment, we're still talking with David Granger from the hit TV show, The Restoration Garage, and also the Guild of Auto Restorers as the owner. David, just before the break, we were talking about the difficulty in finding craftsmen, in the auto restoration industry sector. What's some of the hurdles that you've had to overcome in finding that?
Well, you know, it used to be that when you were restoring cars, you could draw off of the mechanics and painters and body men who were working, in the industry that was associated just with, the everyday cars. That isn't as much the case anymore. I mean, body men are becoming very rare because body panels really aren't repaired anymore. They're replaced. I mean, the seals actually are really hard these days, but once they're bent, you can't, that's it. They're brittle. So you don't have those same processes being used at body shops anymore. So you don't have the kind of guys who have the skills to hammer and pick and do the kind of body work that you need to do on old cars. And the thing we've really been losing is guys who know how to do rust work, because modern cars really don't rust very much. And if they do get rusty, they're just crushed and thrown away, And the same thing with mechanics. I mean, this is even going back 10 years ago. The trend was already very strong. I had a young guy that I'd hired, and I was talking about the updraft carburetor on an old car, and I could see that I was confusing him. And I said, "You know what an updraft carburetor is?" And he sort of said, "Well, I've read about carburetors." And that was 10 years ago, and he'd read about carburetors, but every car he'd ever worked on had been a fuel-injected car. So he, and we get that more and more and more now. You get young guys come in, and this isn't the word of a lie. I had a guy who was probably in his mid-20s. He comes to me and wonders how he can plug in the car that he was working on, but the car was from the 50s, and he sort of gapped it for a minute. He was looking, where do you plug the analyzer in? Because every car he'd ever worked on, you plug it in and the computer tells you what parts that you're going to need. And he was so sort of mindset into that. He wasn't a stupid guy. He just wasn't thinking. He was saying, geez, where do you plug this damn thing in? He wasn't kidding. I thought, wow, this is where we've gotten to with computers and electronics and all that kind of thing. And that it is definitely a throwaway world. I mean, and it's very sad because just when we should be repairing and reusing things, everything that we're given, we just throw away.
Right.
And that's also true of modern cars. I have a lot of people come to me and say, if I was going to buy a car right now and it was going to be an investment car or something you'd restore in 40 years' time, I look at the stuff and say, I'm not absolutely sure that you are going to be able to restore things in 30 or 40 years' time that are being made today, and I'm not sure the will is going to be there to do it either. I have a feeling that in 30 or 40 or 50 years' time, people will still be restoring 50s Chevys and, 60s Fords and all that kind of thing, because those will still be you know, doable. You know, they won't be made out of plastic and computer chips and all that kind of thing. I think that there's going to be a certain, we can see a waning of interest in muscle cars and all that kind of thing right now. Younger people are not terribly caught up with old cars, but I think that's always been the case. I mean, when I was a kid, I didn't want an old car. I wanted that brand new 69 Mach 1, you know. But I think that the culture is sort of leaving the car behind a little bit. So I think what's going to happen is restoration will become more of an art form done by fewer individuals on more important cars. You know, I think that restorers are going to be more conservators than, you know, in 20 or 30 years' time. I think that conservation of cars as historical artifacts and that will be more important than taking your 69 Malibu to the Burger King for the cruise night.
Well, what do you see? These are muscle cars you're talking about as well, but what about the hot rod industry?
Well, you know, hot rods are cool because they are, I think there'll always be people expressing their own individual taste and creativity. And, you know, we saw, you know, there's hot rods, and now, you know, because hot rods became and have become hugely expensive propositions. I mean, custom cars that guys used to do in their backyard are now done by professionals, and they cost $400,000 and $500,000 and $600,000. And I mean, some hot rods in that cost $1 million. The ones that you see at these really high end shows taking home awards that are worth like $1,500 cost the guy, you know, $800,000 or $900,000 to put on the stand. You know, in answer to that, the rat rods came out, and that was basically back to the roots of hot rodding, which in the 1940s and 50s was, you know, young guys who couldn't afford to buy a new car, and there was very few used cars, went and got cars out of junkyards and created a car for themselves, and then they gradually refined those cars. And we've got that with the rat rod thing because, you know, guys couldn't afford custom cars, but they wanted a hot rod. They started building it in the same way as a guy built a car in 1947. But, you know, I even see that changing, and it changes very quickly because media picks up on it and TV picks up on it and everything. So all of a sudden, rat rods become an art form, and they start being built by professionals, and the costs start crescendoing, you know. But,
right.
You know, but fortunately, a guy can still build a rat rod in his backyard and roll out something that's just as good as comes out of a professional shop, but a whole bunch cheaper. Because, you know, he may have spent more hours, but he's not charging himself for them. You know, so there is that. My personal, you know, I really like hot rods, and people say to me, well, you know, you do all these, you know, coach-built cars in the 20s and 30s. And I say, you know, but those were the hot rods of their day. That, you know, these guys took a production car, they pulled the body off it, they put a really beautifully designed one-off body on it, and you know, the owner picked it up and went driving in a car that nobody else had, and that's exactly what custom cars and hot rods and that kind of thing are all about. And you know, they're a statement, and they're an expression, and they're made to suit people's tastes. Yeah. So.
And the paint jobs. I'm all about the paint jobs as well. Really does express a person's taste as well.
Well, it does, yeah. I mean, colors and all that kind of thing, you know, and we've settled into this really sort of, you know, Orwellian world of silver and white. Everybody just buys silver cars and white cars. And, I mean, you go into any parking lot, it's just a sea of, like, no color. And hot rods are enthusiastically colorful most of the time. They have incredible graphics on them. They're just fun. I mean, they're pleasing to the eye, and I don't know why people are afraid of color in cars or anything, because it's just, you know, I don't have any silver cars.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, a lot of the cars that we have, you can find just by the glow coming off of them in the parking lot. But you know, hot rods allow people.
You know what, though? There are some hot rod owners that actually like to maintain the rust on the cars.
Well, that's the rat rodders.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And I mean, that's, and but you know, even that is a process where guys are learning how to apply rust onto the hot rods and maintain the rust, and even painting designs on that into the car bodies with rust. And again, that excites me, and I find that one of the best parts, because people are being creative, you know, and that to me is more interesting than just, you know, making sure that the car is exactly the way that Ford built it in 1947. But, you know, you take that 47 Ford and you create something sort of new and exciting and out of it. That's just fun. And that really does put the fun back into the whole process.
What advice do you have for anyone who actually wants to, two questions. One is to who wants to restore cars as a career opportunity, but then again, also those people who want to have a car restored. So let's start with those who want to restore a car. What advice do you have for them, and what kind of pitfalls do they need to look at?
I you know, if a young guy wants to become a restorer, I mean, he's got really one avenue open to him, and that is he needs to get connected to old cars. There are very, very few colleges in that offer courses in restoration. And, you know, they may be great for some of the basics, but, you know, the best way is to basically become an apprentice, to find a restoration shop that's doing good work and has enough work and who is looking for people. And that's the easiest part. You've got to be, I don't know a restoration shop that's not looking for people. And, you know, get in, sink your teeth in, learn from the people around you, and be patient, because, you know, cars don't actually get restored in 10 minutes. And, you know, I had a coach builder tell me that when he apprenticed for Saunders Row in 1946 in England, he was 6 months sweeping floors, and he said the greatest day in his life was when the foreman came up and said, "Well, you finally learned how to sweep a floor properly, come here." And he set him on a stool in front of the bench, and he gave him a whole bag load of these metal parts and a file, and he says, "File this off of each one of those and bring them to me when you're finished." He said that was the greatest day in his life, because he was now important. He was making a part for a car. And, you know, if you're apprenticing, you're not going to start off doing the glory work. You're going to be starting off doing the dirty stuff. But, you know, the dirty I still do the dirty stuff. Matter of fact, some of that dirty stuff is fun, like stripping cars and cleaning grease and everything. It's, you know, it's all about mindset. And it's always part of the process that achieves that beautiful finished thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as owners are concerned, I think that there are a lot of people out there who fancy themselves as restorers and are quite willing to take money off of people, but really don't, have the ability, they don't have the knowledge, and they may just be con artists. So I think, you know, when you're choosing a restoration shop, you should go and choose a place that's been in business for a few years. You know, I like to say it gives you references, but I mean, anybody's going to give you references. It's not going to give you some of the worst ones. And you also have to be aware that any restoration shop has problem customers, and you can't please all the people all the time, and that's the best way to go bankrupt is trying to do that. But, you know, honesty in what you're doing and a shop's willingness to work with the owner are the two most important things. The owner will get a good feel for the shop, and if they're doing good work, if he spends the time learning enough so that he knows what's going on.
This is a wrap. We're done already. Time has flown by. So I really want to thank
That's
you
why
so
I sort
much.
Of said cruel things at the end.
I know. Yeah, spelled with a K.
That's right.
So I do want to thank you so much for being on the show. And if anyone wants to get a hold of David or myself, you can even email us at coolprojects@americaswebradio. And again, on the Cool Projects website, I will put up all of David's contact information. So, David, thank you again for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Wonderful. And everyone, have a great week. Bye-bye for now.
This is America's Webradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.